since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Sharon couldn't sleep. It was Jay, her boyfriend, who suggested she stay at his house while he was out of town, and since she was currently between apartments, it made perfect sense. But Sharon had been reticent. It wasn't that she didn't like the house. It was positively charming in its Bavarian timber-framed style, nestled high among the hills and trees of LA's Benedict Canyon. In fact, the couple, who'd been seeing each other for almost a year, had spent many happy hours there together, often in the company of their many glamorous friends, spending long, lazy days by the pool, drinking and getting high. But being there alone, and at night, was an entirely different proposition. The place, located at 9860 Eastern Drive, was built sometime in the Prohibition era, and once belonged to Hollywood film producer and writer Paul Byrne. In 1932, Byrne's marriage to Jean Harlow, one of the major film stars of the day and 20 years his junior, brought him to public prominence. However, it was the events that occurred in their home 2 months later that would seal his place in Hollywood infamy. Byrne's butler, John Carmichael, was inspecting the house early one morning when he found Byrne lying naked in the dressing room adjacent to Jean Harlow's bedroom. Assuming he'd collapsed, Carmichael rushed to his help, only to find to his horror that Byrne was lying dead in a large pool of blood. Carmichael saw the single bullet wound in his head, then looking up, the large splattering of blood and soft tissue, still wet and clinging to the ceiling. Sharon tossed and turned in bed. Opening her eyes, she couldn't help but stare at the entrance to that small adjacent room, just visible in the dark, where Byrne's blood-soaked body had once lain. There had long been rumours that the house was haunted, that a mystery surrounding Byrne's death had caused his restless soul to wander and become trapped in that big, eccentric house of his. It was partly what had drawn Jay to the house in the first place when he bought it 2 years back in 1963. Sharon had never let it bother her, until now, that is. She tried to push it all from her mind and get back to sleep, but couldn't escape that creeping sensation that those creaks outside the door weren't just creaks, but footsteps, and they were getting nearer. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard MacLean Smith. Paul Byrne's death was determined to be a suicide after investigators found not only a gun in his hand, but an apparent suicide note left at the scene for his wife. It read, "Dearest dear, unfortunately, this is the only way to make good the frightful wrong I've done you and wipe out my abject humiliation. I love you, Paul." you understand that last night was only a comedy. Only something didn't quite fit. That misspelling of unfortunately from a successful writer, perhaps. Or was it something more? The day after Paul Byrne's body was discovered, a woman boarded the Delta King riverboat in San Francisco, heading for Sacramento. In the early hours of the following day, the woman, Dorothy Millett, Paul Byrne's first wife, was seen standing alone on the top deck, staring out to sea and clearly in some distress. A few hours later, a night watchman found a pair of shoes and a woman's coat on deck, close to where Dorothy had been seen. By the time the boat docked the following morning, Dorothy had completely vanished. Millett's disappearance soon hit the news, with many speculating she had in fact killed Paul Byrne and faked her own death to get away. This speculation was given greater credence when rumours emerged that Byrne had been entertaining a mystery woman at his home the day before his body was found. Years later, producer Samuel Marks, Byrne's friend and colleague at MGM Studios, who employed both Jean Harlow and Paul Byrne, made the stunning revelation that when Byrne's butler first found the body, he called the studio before the police. Their response, according to Marks, was to dispatch Marks and another colleague, Irving Thalberg, to the house to assess the situation before the police arrived. Their aim, allegedly, was to protect the reputation of Jean Harlow, their newest and brightest young star. Harlow was said to have been staying at her mother's house the night Byrne died. Marks claimed to have witnessed Thalberg tampering with the scene. It isn't known to what extent it was tampered with, if it was at all, though it's been suggested that the gun found in Byrne's hand by police had not been there when the butler first found his body. A week after Millett disappeared, two fishermen working on the Sacramento River found her body, floating face down in the water. Over the next few days, a number of stories were spun, some alleging that Dorothy had murdered her husband after discovering he changed his will so that Harlow would be the sole beneficiary. At that time in her life, Millett, who'd been plagued by ill health and recently spent time in a sanatorium, had become entirely dependent on Byrne's financial support. Friends of Byrne's, however, spoke of his struggles with depression due to the publicity surrounding his marriage to Harlow and how he'd previously contemplated suicide. While at the same time, MGM Studios, apparently worried by the fallout to Harlow, should it be proved that Byrne had been cheating on her, supposedly made their own attempts to muddy the waters, allegedly implying that Byrne's failure to satisfy his wife sexually had driven him to suicide. Byrne's death was said by some to have put a curse on the house, with at least one other person rumoured to have committed suicide there, and another drowning in the pool since it had happened. Perhaps it was this that was racing through Sharon's mind as she heard yet another creak coming from out in the hallway, powerless to resist the thought of Byrne's blood-stained body lying naked only yards away, the blood-splattered ceiling, and his vacant, dead eyes. Enough was enough. Sharon switched on the light and sat up in bed. Just then, a sudden movement outside the bedroom caught her eye. As she peered out into the darkness beyond, she saw to her horror that something was out there, hovering in the doorway. It was a man, shortish in stature, with a small moustache and a strange look on his face. He looked exactly like Paul Byrne. Sharon could only watch in terror as the man burst suddenly into the room, moving wildly about the place at double speed. Sharon leapt from the bed, grabbed her robe, and ran shrieking into the hallway. Fleeing to the stairs, Sharon raced down the steps, only to be confronted by an even more hideous sight. A body tied up with rope at the bottom of the stairs, just visible in the darkness, with its throat slit wide open, and blood gushing out of it. Sharon screamed as she hurried through into the living room, slamming the door shut behind her as she struggled to come to terms with what was happening. Surely it was a dream, she thought, as she paced manically about the room. It was just one of those all-too-real, lucid dreams that emerge when the mind flutters about in that liminal space between sleep and wakefulness. But what was that figure tied up to the stairs? It looked so familiar, she thought. Was it Jay? Or had it, in fact, been a vision of herself? Deciding she wanted a drink, she heard a voice echoing from a distant place, telling her to look at the bookshelf and convincing her further that it was just a dream. Moving to the shelves, she found herself frantically searching for something, despite having no idea what she was looking for. But as she ran her fingers along the books, she found a button and pressed it. With a click, the bookshelf popped open to reveal a secret bar space behind. Grabbing a bottle from within, she quickly poured herself a drink. As she gulped it down, she became transfixed by the wallpaper lining the bar inside. Reaching out to touch it, she couldn't help but tear a piece of it away, revealing a copper panel behind it. She pulled another strip, and then another. Finishing her drink, Sharon made her way back to the hall. Peering out toward the bottom of the stairs, she caught sight of the horrifying figure once more, still tied up to the banister, its neck still gushing with blood. Then a movement upstairs drew her attention to the peculiar man again, who was now moving about on the landing. "It's only a dream," she reminded herself. Closing her eyes, Sharon jumped onto the stairs and sprinted back to the bedroom, closing the door quickly behind her. Then the sound of another voice, calling her name from somewhere, getting louder and louder. A voice she recognized immediately as Jay's. And then she opened her eyes. Sharon awoke to find herself back in bed, hearing the sound of Jay's voice calling from downstairs. Moments later, he was at the door, greeting her with a smile. Sharon laughed with relief as she tried to explain the peculiar nightmare she'd been having. She was still explaining it to him as the couple made their way downstairs for breakfast when Sharon caught sight of the mess in the living room. The bookcase bar was open, and at the base of it was a small pile of wallpaper, ripped out from the inside. It was certainly a compelling story, thought Dick. But what does it mean? Asked Sharon. It was August 1968, and with Sharon, now a rising star herself in Hollywood, the pair were sat in a trailer on the set of her latest movie, The Wrecking Crew, a spoof spy comedy that Sharon was starring in alongside Dean Martin. Dick, a Hollywood correspondent working for the newspaper Enterprise Association, at the time had come to interview her for an article he was writing about the production of the film. Her story had been a response to Dick's final question, something he liked to ask all his interviewees. Had she ever had any psychic experiences? Sharon sat back in her chair and took another drag of her cigarette as Dick racked his brains for an answer. I mean, was it a dream? Was it ghosts? She asked, adamant it was the only experience of that kind she'd ever had. Dick was stumped. Maybe the peculiar man she'd seen was a ghost, he thought. The troubled spirit of Paul Byrne, perhaps? But the horrific vision of the mutilated figure on the stairs that she recognized as either herself or her boyfriend Jay, that he couldn't explain. Rosemary Kent, a woman who lives on the edge of the infamous Black Hills Forest, needs your help to find her missing son. But to find him, you must investigate the mysterious forest yourself. Will you face down the horror of the Blair Witch and those who serve her? Blair Witch is the new horror subscription game brought to you by Hunt a Killer in partnership with Lionsgate, a fully immersive experience in the Blair Witch universe delivered straight to your door, and it's scary as hell. With a full season comprising of 6 boxes or episodes, each box will have you sifting through cryptic documents, discovering audio recordings, and solving some disturbing puzzles. Whether you're social distancing or struggling to find somewhere fun to go out for the night, this is the perfect game to play at home with a small group of friends, or even online via video calls, picking through the clues together under candlelight from the comfort of your own home. Right now, just for listeners of Unexplained, you can go to hunterkiller.com/BWUnexplained and use your promo code BWUnexplained at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to hunterkiller.com/BWUnexplained for 20% off and to show support for the podcast. Once again, that's hunterkiller.com/BWUnexplained. Will you survive the curse of the Blair Witch? By 1968, Sharon and Jay were no longer together. In 1965, not long after that horrifying experience in Jay's house, Sharon had travelled to Europe to shoot the occult horror mystery, Eye of the Devil. Having fallen in love with London in the process, she decided to stay a while once filming had ended. It was there that she was first introduced to Roman, an up-and-coming film director from Poland. Having established himself in 1962 with his breakout film Knife in the Water, Roman was looking to cast his latest film, The Fearless Vampire Killers, when it was suggested to him that he consider Sharon for a part. The Fearless Vampire Killers was to be a parody of the British horror films of the day, epitomised by the famous Hammer Film Productions. The role of Sarah Shargle, the daughter of an innkeeper who would eventually turn into a vampire herself, was to provide the romantic interest of the film's lead character, which, as it happened, would be played by Roman. After much persuasion by the film's executive producer, Marin Ransohoff, who also had a stake in Sharon's career, Roman finally agreed to offer her the role. Though they clashed at first, through the course of filming in 1966, the pair embarked on an affair. Before long, they were immersed in the thick of swinging 60s London together, bouncing from one party to the next, hanging with all the bright young stars in Soho, or along the King's Road at all the most fashionable clubs and bars. Roman made it clear early on that he was not the monogamous type, but Sharon, who would have preferred him to be, couldn't resist the way she felt about him. Though he was a little on the short side, she'd been seduced by his sheer sense of inner conviction and confidence. He seemed beyond manipulation in a way, utterly self-assured and resistant to external forces. That he was unwilling to even countenance dedicating himself to her alone, she reasoned, was merely further evidence of his beguiling free-spiritedness. And London, for her, in the increasingly rare social circles that she was beginning to find herself in, was intoxicating, populated, as she said, with free thinkers feeling their way through life and leaving an impression on the times. Being the daughter of a United States Army officer, Sharon, who was by then 24, revelled in the youthful rebellion and urgency of the day. It was a mind-expanding revolution of colour and thought, catalysed by a ubiquity of pot and other mind-altering substances that only served to further expose the rigid status quo. And she was at the epicentre of it all. 5,000 miles away, another young woman had also just secured the part of a vampire, in a somewhat less auspicious production. By 1967, Susan had been living in San Francisco for just over a year when she took a job as a go-go dancer, working at a number of clubs on the North Beach Strip. Nights were long, usually running from 4 p.m. till 2 in the morning, before moving on to the next club to dance until dawn, in the hope of maybe being spotted by a talent agent. It was while dancing one night that Susan, only 18 years old at the time, was introduced to Anton LaVey. LaVey and his followers had been causing a stir with the recent establishing of his Church of Satan. Though many found the group alarming, in truth, it was little more than an individualist occult movement that practiced magic, more opposed to the orthodoxies of Christianity than in thrall to any actual Satan. LaVey was developing a production based around the idea of a witch's Sabbath and was looking for women to play the part of alluring, scantily clad vampires who would terrorize the audience as the Sabbath was conducted. Susan, needing the money, had reluctantly taken the job, often relying on acid in order to find the courage to perform. Though the show was a hit, it had come at a moment of crisis for Susan. Having become heavily immersed in the San Francisco scene, her drug use had steadily intensified and her health, both mental and physical, was shot. 4 months later, she had a breakdown and was admitted to hospital. As someone who felt she'd spent her whole life looking for somewhere to belong, it was clear that where she was then wasn't it. Her collapse was a wake-up call that brought her to the more mellow confines of Haight-Ashbury, a counterculture mecca, and the centre of what would later become known as the Summer of Love. It was while walking along the streets of Haight-Ashbury one afternoon that Susan bumped into Barbara, an old friend from her hometown of Los Banos. Susan had always thought Barbara a little square, so was surprised to find her there of all places. But Barbara had evolved somewhat from the innocent-seeming farm girl Susan had thought her to be. With the political turmoil of 1960s America, lurching from the successful civil rights movement one moment to being mired in an increasingly messy war in Vietnam the next, many Americans were beginning to question just what a free world was exactly. What was happening in Haight-Ashbury offered a glimpse of a different world, a world that was no longer bound by the restrictive social conventions of the day, a place in which, often with the aid of LSD and marijuana, you could shed every label, tag, and assumption that had ever weighed you down. Like Susan, Barbara had also been drawn there by its alluring promise of new ways to exist. She invited Susan back to the house she was living in to meet her new family, as she called it. The house was a large two-story townhouse on the corner of Oak and Lion Street, right next door to Janis Joplin's home. Once there, Barbara showed Susan around the property and introduced her to the 10 other people that were living there as part of a commune, one woman for each man. But Susan noticed there were presently 6 men to only 5 women. Susan sat and smoked pot with them as they explained to her how it worked. They all shared everything in common except each other, with the man-to-woman pairings being strictly monogamous. They made money by selling dope on the street, with each man being a dealer, and the women tasked with finding people to sell it to. When Barbara suggested Susan move in with them to make up the numbers, she jumped at the chance. Having wrapped up production on The Fearless Vampire Killers, Roman and Sharon had returned together to Los Angeles. Unable to find somewhere to settle down, due in part to Roman's reluctance to become too rooted anywhere, but also their naturally transient work life, the couple rented a room at the Chateau Marmont before moving into a house in Benedict Canyon in the Hollywood Hills. The house, which they rented from Oscar-winning actor Patty Duke, quickly became a regular hangout for the couple's burgeoning and increasingly high-profile group of friends. Everyone from Steve McQueen and Dennis Hopper to Candice Bergen and Mia Farrow, from the Mamas and the Papas to Jim Morrison. The house was so often visited, people soon became accustomed to Sharon and Roman's relaxed nature, where the door seemed permanently open so that almost anyone could come and go as they pleased. As part of the agreement to rent the house, the couple had agreed to look after Patty's English sheepdog when one morning it bolted out of the property. Giving chase, Roman tracked it to a house a little further down the road. The house was being used by members of the Process of the Final Judgment, otherwise known simply as the Process. The group was a religious movement of sorts, established in London in 1966, inspired in part by Scientology, Aleister Crowley, and the work of psychologist Alfred Adler. There were rumours that they participated in nefarious rituals, but Roman knew little of that, only that they were well known for keeping large Alsatian dogs as pets, a fact he became plainly aware of that day when, on seeing him draw near to the property, two of them chased him into a nearby garage. In desperation, as the dogs barked manically outside, the traumatized Roman was forced to break a window before leaping out the back of the building and hurriedly making his escape. Back in San Francisco, Susan's commune was attracting the attention of the FBI. One day, while out with two of the men, Susan realized they were being followed by a couple of plain-clothed officers. The group decided to split up, with Susan hightailing it in one direction and the others heading off in another. When Susan returned to the house later that afternoon, a little stoned from a joint she just smoked, she heard the sound of a guitar and someone singing coming from one of the rooms above. Following the sound, she drifted softly up the stairs in her bare feet toward the doorway of the living room. There, sat on the sofa, was a shortish man, clean-shaven with long dark hair, playing the guitar. He was dressed in a white t-shirt, blue jeans and sandals, and had multicolored beads draped around his neck. On either side of him sat a woman, while on the ground, other women sat at his feet as they watched him, his eyes closed and head tilted back, singing gently into the air. The room, thick with the smell of pot and incense, was hazy with smoke that curled and played with the soft light of the afternoon. Susan couldn't take her eyes off the man. Just then, for a moment, he opened his eyes and fixed her with his stare, as if beckoning her to go in. Unable to resist, Susan stepped inside and took a seat at the singer's feet. Looking up at him from below, lit up behind by the soft afternoon light, he looked like an angel. She was still staring at him when she realized he was no longer singing, but talking to the woman next to him. Just then, a thought popped into her head that she would like to play his guitar. Without having said a word, the man turned to her suddenly and said, "Why don't you play it?" Susan was shocked. Had he just read her mind? In that moment, she knew immediately that this was the thing she'd been looking for. Without thinking, Susan smiled at the man and then bent down and kissed his feet. Just then, the sounds of Jefferson Airplane began to emanate from a record player. Lured by the rhythm, Susan pulled herself up and began to dance. Unbeknownst to her, the man put down his guitar and walked over to join her. Moving in close behind, he leant in and whispered in her ear, "No two actions are the same. Everything is new. Let it be new," he said. Before long, they were fused, mirroring each other's moves. At one point, it seemed to Susan that they'd even travelled through each other's bodies. The music swelled, growing in speed and intensity, and their movements did the same, becoming more and more wild, until suddenly, the music stopped. "You're beautiful," said the man. "I'm Susan," she said in reply. "Who are you?" "Me," said the man. "I'm Charlie, Charlie Manson." You've been listening to part one of Unexplained Season 5, Episode 5, When Love Breaks Down. Part two will be released next Friday, November 13th. If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, discount on merchandise, as well as brand new video and audio content exclusive to Patreon members, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Or if you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide you can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.